So, tonight we'll talk about wisdom. And I shared with someone, I don't know how much experience I have at wisdom, but the topic is what is it and where does it come from? So we'll explore this tonight together. And I think it's a pretty good policy to start out a Dharma talk with something from the Buddha. You know, it's like knowing, you know, he's got my back, you know. So here's something from the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha's teachings. And he says, wisdom arises from practice. Without practice, it is lost. Knowing these two ways of gain and loss, conduct yourself so that wisdom grows. So Buddhism is often referred to as a wisdom tradition. And this practice that we undertake as we move towards freedom, towards awakening, is supported and expressed by a deep understanding of how life is, which we know is wisdom or insight. I mean, true wisdom is understanding the nature of our mind and understanding what reality really is, and letting go of delusions and misconceptions and myths that we carry with us. So this wisdom is really a basic understanding of this. It's seeing things as they are rather than how we'd like them to be. It's not wisdom if we just believe what we're told. And I know for me, and for many of you perhaps, you know, when we grew up, you know, we were expected to believe certain things. And that's true in a lot of faith traditions. It's like, well, this is the way it is. Well, that's not how it works in the Dharma. In fact, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, has said repeatedly that, you know, here we have a 2,500-year-old teaching. But if science proves that the Buddha had it wrong about something, we're going to go with science. You know, we just don't accept things just because that's what it's been, you know, we've been told. So wisdom is sometimes referred to as prajna or panya. Now, prajna is the term in Sanskrit that you often see in the Mahayana tradition, Zen and Tibetan. We use the word panya in the Theravadan tradition that we come from, P-A-N-N-A. And the end has one of those little, what are those things anyway?
Squiggles.
It's got a little squiggle over, you know? And we're going to talk about panya in more in depth. But wisdom is different than knowledge. You know, you can go to school and you get a whole bunch of letters after your name and you accumulate a lot of knowledge. And you might get a PhD. But you know what PhD stands for, don't you? Piled higher and deeper. Right? So, you know, and there's value in knowledge, but it's not the same as wisdom. So I want to talk just a little bit about the paramis or paramita. Again, it's the difference between Pali and Sanskrit. So we use the term the paramis, and the paramis are qualities of mind that we're striving to attain on this path. And the thing about wisdom as one of the paramis is it's supported by the others and it directs them. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these, but give you an idea that this relationship is symbiotic. For example, mindfulness is another one of the paramis. Well, wisdom needs mindfulness to be able to pick up on what's happening and develop insight, to develop wisdom. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when I get to the Eightfold Path. Another one of the paramis is effort. Well, it takes effort to keep that mindfulness alive. Ethics. Well, ethics is a guide and it's a foundation to know what to do, what to say. Another paramis is patient forbearance. That's so that we can be with difficulties and allow them to instruct the moment, to know how to use grist for the mill. Right? A generous attitude of openness and curiosity is very important. So these other paramis help facilitate wisdom. But likewise, wisdom guides the paramis. For example, without wisdom, these others just become aimless or wayward. You know, without really understanding how things are, they can just wander off course. For example, a generous act without wisdom could result in harm. The fact that we want to do something for someone else, if we don't really have wisdom and insight, how do we know that it's really an act of generosity? For example, giving a knife to a child as opposed to a surgeon. Another example, it might be appropriate to forbear an angry attack from a colleague, having wisdom to understand how to handle a situation like that rather than just reacting. And so on and so on. So, I want to talk about the Four Noble Truths. The very first teaching of the Buddha was, you know, it's called the Turning of the Wheel, and it was the Four Noble Truths, which basically the first noble truth is the truth of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. The fact that all conditioned phenomena and experiences are ultimately unsatisfying. And the second noble truth is the cause, which comes from craving and clinging what is pleasurable and aversion to what is unpleasurable. And this just continues the cycle of rebirth and ignorance and suffering. And then the third noble truth is the truth of how to end it, how to put an end to this craving and suffering, this clinging. And what that is pointing to is the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. So, you know, it was great when the Buddha reached enlightenment, you know, and decided to teach for the next 45 years. He didn't make it real mysterious. He said, look, here's how it works. We're gonna show you the path. And it's called the Eightfold Path. I mean, he laid it right out. And he was very clear. You follow this and you will reach awakening. Now, it doesn't mean it's easy. But it wasn't a big mystery. So let's talk about the Eightfold Path. And this is one of my favorite topics because it just ties everything in together. It's important to understand that the Eightfold Path is not linear. Okay? It's not like, okay, got number one, check, we're good. Number two, all right, 25% of the way there, man. You know, we keep going, just check, check, check. You know, like we're driving to Knoxville or something. It's not like that at all. It's kind of like a three-legged stool, and each of them are needed, and each of them support each other. It's also been pictured like a wheel. So you have, like, the wheel with the arrows, so they all work together. Lee Brazington, who's one of my primary teachers, and he comes here and does talks when he is at Southern Dharma. He says it's like an 8-lane highway, and you're just moving back and forth. Hopefully not like L.A. drivers, where you go, like, oh, there's my exit. It's a little bit more skillful, you know. But so the Eightfold Path, basically, the first one is right view. Now, when we say right, it's not like right, wrong, you know, it's more like correct. So, but we use the term right. So the first one is right view, which is sometimes known as right understanding. And the second of the Eightfold Path is right intention, or sometimes referred to as right resolve. So right view and right intention are the first two steps. And those are the two parts of the Eightfold Path that are considered part of the wisdom aspect. See, the Eightfold Path is divided up into three areas. Remember I said it was a three-legged stool? It's wisdom, or panya. Another aspect of it is sila, or ethics. And the other aspect is concentration, or samadhi. So we've got concentration, wisdom, and ethics, and they all work together. So the first two are wisdom, right intention, or right view and right intention. Now the next three are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Now this is the ethics part. This is sila. And ethics really are kind of primarily contained right in the five precepts. There's a reason why if you go to Theravadin retreats, you know, insight retreats, that at the very beginning they ask that you take the precepts. That's how we start out. Because that's really the foundation. Without practicing the precepts, how do we know that we're actually generating a wholesome mind state to do the practice? So that's the second part. Then the third part is concentration, or samadhi. And that's right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So the foundation is ethics. It's kind of like, well, let me say this. The foundation is ethics. And then if you're living an ethical life and you're practicing the precepts, which are no killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no false speech, and no use of intoxicants. You know, if you're practicing those, it gives you a foundation to develop concentration, right? And as Lee Brazington said, it's pretty hard to develop concentration if you're out there robbing banks and screwing people over and wondering when people are going to catch up with you, right? So I like to think of that as like the first floor, the foundation is ethics, and then you have concentration. And we need to develop concentration, we need to develop focus before we can start doing insight practices. So if we think about the practice that we do, what's the first thing that we ask you to do after you establish posture? Is to bring your awareness to your breath. And when we do that practice and continue to bring our awareness back to our breath, or any object of concentration, people use other things, sometimes mantras, or they may use, for example, loving kindness practices, anything to generate concentration. We do that so that we can start developing focus. And once we have our focus, then we start noticing what arises in our mind. And if we have some level of concentration, we can start seeing patterns of what's arising in our mind. You know, if I'm doing this and I'm able to notice what's arising in my mind, I might see, for example, wow, I'm always in the past. I'm always thinking about stuff that happened. I'm totally lost in stories. Or, and this happens to be mine, okay? Fessing up. I'm a planner. Right? And I'm good. I'm a real good planner. But it's not necessarily a good idea to always be in the future, right? But when I notice, you know, my thoughts, that's usually what's happening is I'm planning. But I can only notice that if I develop some stability and you know, in my mind, some stillness, so that I can really observe what's going on. Those are insights. That's wisdom. So, we establish the foundation of ethics, we start developing concentration, and then we start doing wisdom practices. And there are many, many, many insight or wisdom practices that the Buddha taught us to use. I imagine most of you are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm quoting him. He says, in Buddhism, precepts, concentration, and insight always go together. It's impossible to speak of one without the other. Practicing the precepts brings about concentration, and concentration is needed for insight. Concentration allows us to look deeply, and insight is the fruit of looking deeply. The three are intertwined. Each helps the other two. All three bring us closer to final liberation. There you have it. So it's not me. It's not just me saying this, right? I mean, this is like a living, walking Buddha. I mean, this is it. Jack Kornfield's primary teacher was a Thai by the name of Ajahn Chah, and he says, with virtue as the basis of everything we do, our mind will become kind, clear, and quiet, and meditation will grow from this soil. See? The ethics, the foundation. So this is the Eightfold Path, and this is how it works together. And wisdom is the fruit. So, the Buddhist tradition distinguishes three kinds of wisdom, and each has a place in the spiritual path. And so, the first that they talk about is through reading and learning and studying. So, we got a library here. We got the internet. So, you can, you know, read these books and study. You can listen to Dharma talks on dharmaseed.org and all kinds of sources. And then the second is discussion and reflection. And you notice we always have time for discussion after a Dharma talk. It's really important. We can learn from that. We can get insight from that, from hearing other people's experiences. Because Scott or Suzanne or Bill or someone might share something and I go, oh, wow, I had the same experience, and learn from what they share. And then the third part comes from the meditation practice. So I have an analogy, and Kate, this may sound a little familiar. And it has to do with going to a restaurant. Now, I happen to love Indian food. And, you know, most Indian restaurants, you may not know this, but most of them feature food from the north of India. Most of them feature food from the Punjab region. And I like that food. But it's very seldom that you get to go to an Indian restaurant and experience food from the south. And they have some very different dishes in the south. So, you know, I'm always on the lookout. So let's say maybe I'm in Atlanta. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I got a chance down here. It's a big city. And I'm going down the street, and I see an Indian restaurant. I go up, and I look at the menu, and they've got Thali-style dishes. Now, Thali-style is you get a big plate, and they got all these little curries and chutneys and stuff around the outside, and then they put rice or naan bread in the middle, and that's how you eat. And that's how I ate when I was in the south of India. Except I didn't eat with my hands. I had a fork in my backpack. So, oh wow, it's Thali style. What else do they have? Well, they've got dosas. Dosas are, I'm making everybody's mouth water probably. The dosas are like these little crepes, these little, and they have these fillings in it, and they're so good. And then they have idli, which are these little steamed cakes made with fermented lentils and rice. And they've got biryani, which is rice with vegetables and spices. So I'm reading the menu and I'm thinking, this could be good. You know, maybe I'm onto something. Maybe I've learned something about where I can get a good Indian meal, right? So this is like the first step, right? So I said, okay, I'm going in, and I sit down and I talk to the food server. They don't call them waiters anymore, right? So I say, come on, you know, fess up. Is this really good? And he goes, oh, yeah, this is amazing. And then I'm talking to the people in the chairs around me, and they go, oh, man, this place is banging, you know. This is the only place I come for Indian food. And they're smacking their lips, and they're having a great time, and, you know, I'm talking to them and just kind of reflecting on this whole thing, and I'm thinking, this could be good. This is like the second stage, right? I'm not having a direct experience, and I'm more than just reading the menu. I'm having discussion and reflection. But do I really know? I don't know until they bring the food. And that's where I have the direct experience. And eating that food is like a meditation. That takes on that same element. So, you know, with the Dharma, you know, we can read the menu. We can talk about it. But what do we got to do? right? To really get all the components of wisdom. So, this is the practice. You know, it's important to study, it's important to reflect and digest on things like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and impermanence, non-self, karma, dependent co-arising. But we can learn from these things. There's a great quote by Muhammad Ali who said, "The man who looks at the world the same way at 50 that he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life." Okay, I believe that's true. So, the third kind of wisdom is really developing our meditation. This is an understanding that arises from developing our qualities of mind through mindfulness. This is eating, tasting, and direct experience. So most people, most of us, a lot of times, we just kind of take our experience for granted and just look at the surface. But once we start developing mindfulness, once we really start looking deeply at what's going on in our mind and start looking deeply at the experience of life, then it's not filtered through old ways of looking at things. And it becomes clearer. And as our mindfulness deepens and as things become clearer, we start seeing the characteristics of existence. There are really three characteristics of existence that the Buddha talked about. Impermanence, the fact that nothing is fixed and unchanging, nothing lasts forever. That there's no lasting happiness. You know, if we cling to pleasure, it's just going to create more suffering. And also the fact that there's no independent self that exists separate from other, you know, fixed independent self. You know? And this is anicca, anatta, adukkha, and dukkha, the three characteristics of existence. And we can have direct experience of this through our meditation. As we watch our thoughts arise and pass away, as we watch physical sensations arise and pass away, that's a direct experience of impermanence. I was just on a retreat. Kate and I went down for a 10-day intensive retreat in Georgia, and it was the first time that I've been able to sit for an hour and a half or 2 hours without experiencing discomfort. It arose, but the practice that I was doing allowed it, I was able to just let it pass away rather than cling to the aversion that I had to my ass falling asleep or whatever was going on. You know, or the mosquito bites, because there were some mosquitoes down there, let me tell you. So I would notice the itch, but I would just, the practice allowed me to just witness the arising and passing away and have direct experience of insight. It wasn't reading it in a book, and it wasn't hearing somebody else talk about it. It was direct experience through meditation. So I want to give you an example of how to use this practice. And this is something that I learned from someone who was fairly new at meditation. And I teach meditation or involved in groups of various kinds. And this happened in a meeting that I go to that links mindfulness meditation and addiction recovery. And there was a fellow there, we'll call him Tim, because that's his name. And I'm not blowing his anonymity because you're never going to meet him, okay? So Tim is a big guy. I mean, we're talking big guy. And he's been in recovery a little while. He's kind of got a handle on his recovery program. But meditation is new. But one of the issues that he deals with, and he was very open about this, was he has a lot of problems with anger and with rage. And it would happen at work, and somebody would say something, and he would get upset, and he would launch into a tirade. And he shared with a group, he said, I'm on a short leash. If this keeps happening, they love me at work for the work I do, but they're going to fire me if I go off on somebody else again. So we learn, you know, he was working with the meditation, and it's a body-centered practice, right? So we talked about developing concentration and noticing sensations that arise in the body. And for people in active addiction, and I'm one of them, I'm a person in long-term recovery, but I spent a lot of time in addiction, is I never learned real well how to be okay with being uncomfortable. As soon as I didn't like the way I felt, I told myself, I know how to fix this, right? Well, at a certain point, the consequences were pretty severe, and I had to shift and learn how to be okay with being uncomfortable. So meditation gives me a tool to do that. So what I can do is, when a sensation arises, I can just bring my awareness to it, focus on it in my body, and what happens? What happens when I bring my awareness to the sensation? It shifts. It doesn't last forever. It goes away. If there's a craving, if there's a physical sensation I don't like, if there's a nagging thought I don't like, if I bring my awareness to it with compassion, see, and kindness, and watch it, it'll pass away. So we talked about this practice. So Tim comes in, and he says one day, he says, I got something to share. He's got this gruff voice, kind of talks like this. He says, today I was at work, and this woman said something, and I got really pissed off. And he says, I stopped for a minute, and I took a breath. And I noticed my breath, and I noticed a sensation in my chest. He says, it was right here. It was right in my chest. He says, I knew that was my anger. Mm-hmm. And he says, I just brought my awareness there for a second. I took a breath, and then I looked at her, and I said, I need a couple of minutes. And I walked away. And I turned to the guy that kind of co-runs it, and I looked at him and I went, yes! Yes, yes. Because he got it. He got it. That's the practice. That's insight. That's wisdom. And for him, that's transformative. And he proved to himself, and that's what he was telling us. He says, I know now that I'm not a slave to my sensations and my feelings. I know I can work with them. That's how meditation can generate wisdom. I've had the same experience. I remember years ago I was house sitting for somebody. I was living in Silver City, New Mexico, and these people had a dog and a cat. Well, you know, cats sometimes have a habit of bringing things into the house that they catch. So I would find various animals of stages of aliveness and deadness, and I would rescue them or dispose of them, and that's just part of the deal, right? Well, one morning I woke up and I started smelling something, and I look under my bed and there's a dead bird. And I went and got this broom out of the closet, and I fished it out, and it was like maggots, and it was disgusting. And I look, and sitting on the chair was the cat. And looking at me like, look what I did. Aren't I cool? Isn't that what you pay me to do? And I'm looking for something to throw at it, right? But I had the same experience. I stopped, I took a breath, I noticed the sensation, and then I asked myself, is this experience the truth? You know, did this cat wake up this morning or yesterday and say, I'm gonna make Eddie's life miserable, and I'm gonna do, no. So I worked with it. See, so these are experiences. But it takes the practice. Who here has been to London? Okay, well, a lot of people. Did you ride on the tube? The tube is what they call the underground. Do you remember the signs they have and the announcement they make in the tube before the doors open? What do they say? Mind the gap. What does that mean, Dan?
It means there's a little space between the platform and the...
Oh, a space between... So mind the gap. That's what Tim did. He minded the gap. The space between the sensation and the response. That's what we do. We mind the gap. And when we do, we get insight. So there's a practice that we've talked about, you may have heard about, called RAIN, R-A-I-N. Some of you heard about it. And now, it's a lot of people think that Tara Brach, who's a wonderful teacher, is the one that came up with that. She actually isn't. She's popularized it, but it was actually another teacher called Michelle McDonald who really came up with this. And RAIN is an acronym. The R is for?
Recognize.
Recognize. The A is for?
Allow.
The I is for?
Investigate.
And the N is for?
Non-identify.
Boy, we got some all-stars in here. Yeah. So this is the practice. So this is what we can do when we have an experience. We recognize and just put our attention, our focus on it, noticing what's happening inside me right now. And bringing that curiosity to it, whether it's a thought, an emotion, a physical sensation. What's going on here? Well, we need some concentration to do that, right? Because if our mind is constantly going, we're not going to notice. So recognize. Then allow. Ask ourselves, can I be with this? Can I allow this to exist just the way it is? Or do I have to fix it? You know, if I'm sitting in meditation and I notice a little bit of discomfort, do I have to shift my position right away? Can I bring my awareness? Can I accept it? Can I be with it? Just one example. Investigate. Okay, what am I believing about this experience? What am I believing about myself, about life, about others? Is it true? And it can be like peeling an onion. You know, I might have some initial thoughts about it, some initial awarenesses, and then I can get a little deeper and look underneath. It's all just this gentle inquiry, just allowing the whole thing to arise and looking at it with compassion. And then N is the non-identification, recognizing we're not our thoughts. We're not our feelings. We're not our sensations. We're not defined by the stories about ourselves. And I teach at a residential aftercare program. I teach meditation to guys in early recovery. And a lot of these guys are really eager beavers. I mean, they're really taken to this. So we talked about this, and one of the guys says, I have a question. I go, yeah. He goes, well, is that the difference between saying, I'm an angry person, and saying, I'm experiencing anger? And I had another one of these, yes! You nailed it! That's it! It's non-identification. So, the first three steps of RAIN involved intentional activity, just recognizing, allowing, and investigating. The third is just a natural awareness. It's just going, this isn't who I am. So these practices allow us to see how we create suffering for ourselves. It's what the Buddha taught.